Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, introducing our special edition two-part series on visual storytelling. This first episode features Carlo Nasise and Eva Rendell, two filmmakers who visited Missoula for the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. I'll begin by speaking with Carlo Nasise about the film he made with Luca Yin-Yin Yang called Kobe and Steven Are in Love. Stay with us. Kobe and Steven Are in Love is a love story between Kobe, a 92-year-old retired nightclub dancer and icon from San Francisco Chinatown's golden age, and Steven, a man 20 years her junior who has aspired to be an experimental filmmaker since the 1960s anti-war movement. How on earth did you come across Kobe and Steven, and what was the process of deciding to do a film together like?
It's actually kind of a funny story. Luca Yin-Yin Yang and I were both fellows at Union Docs, which is an organization for documentary art in Brooklyn. And she was working on a feature film, and she was about to go film in Havana, Cuba. And it kind of came out that she needed a DP or cinematographer. And when I'm not directing films, that's what I do to make money. So I was like, oh, sure, absolutely. And so we went to Cuba, and it was with a bunch of Chinese Americans, sort of elderly Chinese Americans who had histories in dance and performance. And so we ended up meeting Kobe and Steven there. And we were there for about a week and a half, I believe. And most nights it ended up being that Kobe and Steven and I would go out dancing in the evenings because they wanted to dance. I was the only person who spoke Spanish. And so we obviously didn't want to send a 92-year-old woman. And also, we became friends really quickly. And I remember we were at a nightclub one night, and Luca and Kobe were dancing, and Steven was in my ear telling me the stories of his life and the anti-war movement and how meeting Kobe sort of saved his life in a lot of ways. And I just looked at the sort of cultural bricolage of the situation and how close we had all become so quickly. Like, it just sort of clicked into place. You know how you have like golden eras of your life, or like golden moments? Like, that week in Cuba will always be that for Luca and I believe. And I whispered in Luca's ear, I was like, we really should make a film about these guys. Like, what's happening here with us is pretty special. So, and Luca's just like the most amazing person. She's actually in Beijing right now and is sort of sequestered at home because of the coronavirus, and which is very sad. But she's an amazing visual artist. This was her first film that she did, and so it was kind of fun to do that together. And she was like, oh yeah, absolutely. Like, we have to, let's do this. Should we buy tickets? And I was like, yeah, sure. So we bought tickets to see them like 3 weeks later, and we went to San Francisco and just made this film together.
So much of the film relies on candid footage, it seems, of these artists. And I was wondering what you were hoping to capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that that's something that we went into the film deciding that we really wanted it to be not to have interviews. We did do interviews, but we ended up wanting it to feel this kind of like that we had sort of landed in their lives and we were just watching things unfold. We wanted it to feel kind of like this. We kept thinking of it as a dance, actually, which is a sort of cute thing because they're dancers, of course, but like it really did feel like that. And you know, sometimes a film, you have to force things, you have to make it work, you have to figure out a way to make people comfortable with the camera, or the storyline is not working, or whatever it is. With this film, it was truly like breathing, you know, like making this film with them felt so easy. And filmmaking oftentimes does not feel easy, like, but this felt so easy. And so I think that that just led to a film that feels, it just unfolds in a very natural way. It was not contrived to make them like not pay attention to the camera. The times when they do, it feels very natural and sort of important for us. So I think that we just wanted it to feel like it felt for us, essentially. And I don't always say that about films. Like, sometimes I'm like, oh man, you wouldn't believe what went into this behind the scenes, yes. You know. So this was something that was very different for me, for sure.
Were there any scenes that surprised you especially?
Well, yeah. Stephen is always a surprise.
Yeah.
Stephen is always a surprise. Man, one thing, well, yeah, I mean, there's one of my favorite things is we go to a sort of sleepy San Francisco Chinatown, not the San Francisco Chinatown that Colby knew as a young woman that was sort of this amazing golden age of nightclub dancing. We went to the sleepy San Francisco Chinatown, and it was a karaoke night put on by some of their friends. And of all songs, Stephen sings Margaritaville,
right,
by Jimmy Buffett, which wouldn't be my first choice of a song ever, basically. But I thought it was, I loved that Stephen chose that song, and it's like his song. And
right.
You'll see in the film that we have like older footage of him, right, singing it into the camera, like his own, like him self recording him singing that. And so I'm filming, and then suddenly I start to feel Colby on the left side of the camera. When you're filming, you don't really, like, you're in the moment. You can't,
you're like
really,
in the frame.
You're in the frame, and you don't really notice always what's going on around you. And I just kind of feel Kobe's presence, and I turn the camera over, and she's walking up on the stage to dance with him. And it becomes this, like, really, really sweet scene, and this very interesting, like, the most literal and beautiful example of the dance between the camera and the subjects.
Yeah.
Like, and then Kobe looks over at me and, like, says, hi, Carlo. And it's this sort of funny, quirky thing that I think, and it's a little bit of a longer take in terms of our film. It's a pretty fast cut film, and this take is a little bit longer. So for me, that was one of the nicest surprises of the film in this moment where, like, I think I can't even remember really filming any of it. It just felt, again, like breathing, like dancing with them or something like that. And it was really sweet. So that's like a very fond memory for me.
Mm. There's also a point in the film when Stephen begins filming, and I was really curious about that interplay between him filming you and then you incorporated his footage into the documentary.
Yeah.
Tell me how that came to be and the decision to collaborate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that documentary is such a weird, it's a really weird thing that we're doing when you film people, you know. And I've not really come to terms with it always. I'm always looking for ways to kind of like turn it around or make it feel less hierarchical or just basically deprivilege your own perspective in some ways. I'll be thinking about that probably for the rest of my life and how to do that better. But that scene for us was a way to think about, I mean, Stephen, wanted to be an experimental filmmaker since the 60s. And so it was very interesting for us to see him looking at us and that we are filmmakers and artists and doing this work. And so to sort of have that collaboration between the two of us and have his perspective and vision in there. And there's a little tug of war in that scene, right? Because
yeah.
He says, okay, I'm going to film you guys now. And then he thinks that we're going to stop filming him, and I don't.
Right.
And it's a little bit of a funny nod to, you know, the kind of behind the scenes nature, like what goes into making a documentary film, and that there is a little bit of a contest sometimes between visions. And I really liked having that in the scene, not to mention the fact that so much of the film is through Stephen's eyes, mm-hmm. You know, that we're mm-hmm. really dependent on Stephen to understand Colby more. She's a pretty private person. Mm-hmm. She had never done an interview prior to this film.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was a very, very private. This was a very surprising thing that she did. And Colby is an icon in San Francisco. I mean, she's a very, you know, revered figure. Probably could be more so if she wanted to be, you know, but it's just not her nature. So Stephen was really, truly the lens through looking at Colby, the art that he makes, the collage, the films. So it was very important for us to see Stephen's vision. And it's also, we also tried to pay attention to that with the ways in which we filmed. The opening of the film was sort of, the ideas that go into a film that maybe sound silly when you say it, but we're just like focusing on his eyes, on his vision, like very, uh-huh. very close up of his eyes and things like that, because we really wanted to signal that relationship.
I noticed the theme of filming through reflection, whether it's through mirrors or through photographs or through sort of refractions of this story. Can you talk about what your intention was around, you know, not always filming subjects straight on, but actually going at them from different angles?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. One, to be totally honest, is just trying to find interesting visuals to tell a story always is. I think a big thing for the film was that we were interested in the ways in which their memories, the ways in which Stephen is really focused on memory and loss and death, to be honest. So the idea of having multi-layered images that sort of reference an image within an image, actual literal photographs and old video for us was a way to think about the ways in which, like, the current moment is constantly being mediated through him and his concerns over memory and over Kobe being remembered, and to a lesser degree, himself being remembered. So for us, we were trying to think of a visual language that would reflect that, basically. So I think that's how we arrived there.
I'm so glad you brought up death, because at one point Stephen says, "We'll die and the film still goes on." And what can you say about documenting, you know, for what purpose?
Yeah, that was, I got shivers when you said that. I mean, that moment was really intense for us, as you can imagine. Like, that was emotional, you know. At a certain point, that the film really, we'd grown much beyond the relationship between a filmmaker and a subject. It doesn't always happen. I like everybody I've made a film with and about, but this was a pretty special experience, I think. And yeah, I mean, there's this kind of classic thing on photography, Roland Barthes and everything, that filmmaking is intimately tied with death and all this stuff like that. And I think that there's something to be said for that. You are creating an image that will last beyond somebody, and I know that was very important for Stephen and is very important for him. I think everything he does is very much tied to a knowledge of, like, the ephemerality of all things. You know, he's a deep thinker, and he's always thinking about these things, really. So the fact that what he does with that is make a poster of Kobe and it says Cleavage Galore on it is amazing to me, because I love the mixture of the sort of deep, a little bit dark thinking, and then also, like, something as lighthearted and beautiful as Cleavage Galore and this magnificent Kobe Yee, you know, on these posters. So and just to be clear, Stephen makes collages out of old photos of Kobe, and they're all over the house for people who have not seen the film. So
there's another line that Stephen says that's a bit wistful, and he addresses you and says, "This film is a connection now to you." What did it mean to you to hear that?
So, you know, being the camera, you get the attention sometimes when something happens like that. Just for the record and the behind-the-scenes image that nobody will ever see, Luca is sitting right next to me in that scene. So, and this is all the two of us. Everything that is happening here is the two of us. And I could almost speak for her at this point. We were so tied and connected when doing this film, and we still are. But I know that, like, that kind of broke our hearts a little bit, because it was just a confirmation of the things that we had been feeling, basically, which is that in the process of doing this, we'd found, you know, family. I know this is getting a little bit, it's a little much almost, but it really is true. Like, I love Kobe and I love Stephen deeply, and they do feel like family to me. And so that was a really beautiful affirmation of, like, for me, documentary filmmaking at its best, or I don't know if I want to say documentary filmmaking, maybe just, like, making work with other people on Earth, and, like, the potential connections that can come when you just have an excuse to make something with somebody, you know? Like, I couldn't really imagine a scenario too naturally where I would accidentally hang out with Kobe and Stephen, you know? So the camera is a passport, really, in so many ways. So the fact that through the camera and through art and making this stuff, we had come together and then had that moment of really intense reflection on what the film meant to all of us. That was very powerful. And still, when I watched that scene, I didn't do a very good job filming that scene. You know, I was a little like distracted.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm like, it's like not super, it's not as in focus as other things in the film. I'm like searching for focus a little bit. It definitely pushed me outside of the role of being a camera operator. So, yeah.
As well as, you know, covering burlesque and their love story and art and, you know, even costume design, you know, the subtext of the film centers around gentrification of San Francisco, ageism, mortality, immigration even. What were the take-home lessons for you in making this film?
Yeah. It's always interesting when you make a project and you don't know how people are going to interpret it. And when we made this film, we were thinking about a lot of things. And, you know, it's like if you're cooking and the ingredients and the steps that go into a sauce or whatever, you don't really know ultimately what's going to make it come out to taste really good or whatever. So I don't know how much these themes ended up like really being prominent in the film. We ended up making some decisions in order to make it a short rather than a feature. But I think that there's this kind of specter in the film, which is the hyper gentrification of San Francisco and the transformation of the city. In making the film, we traveled through all these different communities, mostly immigrant communities of people who go to a Filipino old folks home. We go to these various old folks dances, and they've all been pushed to the outskirts of San Francisco. There's one scene where we go into San Francisco and it's kind of a pain. It's hard to get in. It's hard to park. You know, there's all these things. One time we got our car stuck in a parking lot because it closed. All these things that happen like that. And Colby Yee is, in a lot of ways, like the best of San Francisco. And I think that the relationship between Stephen and Colby is really unique and feels of San Francisco or of a certain era of San Francisco. And now, just as the nightclubs have closed, just as Stephen's moment during the 60s has come to an end, and he's sort of, the 60s seemed to, he avoided the draft and went to Canada, and by the time he got back, it felt that the 60s were over. So there's this tangible sense of faded glory in the film that's very tied to the faded glory of a city that I really used to love. And so it is a little bit sad what has happened to San Francisco. So, and in addition to that, we were thinking absolutely about age, you know, like we're all going to get older someday. And I really hope that my life can be as happy and interesting as Colby and Stevens. So seeing them move and seeing the things that they endeavor to do, I mean, they actually went and visited Luca in China after the film.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They're remarkable. And I, you know, hopefully this is the second film festival we've shown the film at. And so we're going to keep doing stuff with them. And hopefully we are looking towards the future. And we're very excited about collaborating more with Colby and Stephen during the screenings. So we haven't had the chance to bring them out yet, but we definitely plan to do some screenings with them and hopefully a dance or two.
Carlo Nasise is a photographer and filmmaker in Mexico City. To see the trailer of Colby and Stephen Are in Love and to find more information about Carlo and his work, visit our website at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Up next, I'll be speaking with Eva Rendell about the film All That Remains. A year after deadly wildfires ravaged Northern California's wine country, its vulnerable population of farm workers, many of them undocumented, find themselves in a heightened state of insecurity and inequality. All That Remains is a portrait of the second responders and vineyard workers who are still dealing with the aftermath of the fires long after the media has turned away. Eva, how did this story capture you?
So this film was my master's thesis project while I was in grad school at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And the fires hit during my first month of grad school, and I was reporting on immigration issues at the time. So I immediately went up to Napa and started talking to people to figure out kind of how farm workers were impacted, because I knew that about 70% of people that pick the grapes and do the vineyard labor in wine country don't have legal immigration status. So I started following it then and just sort of followed the story over the next really year and a half. And the media was covering this issue a lot. There was a lot of talk about how undocumented workers weren't eligible for FEMA assistance. So if they lost their home or they lost their wages, they couldn't get any help. And there was a lot of the community really stepped in and created a fund for them. And there was a lot of assistance there. But the people I was talking to just talked about all these other ways that people are affected and the way the fires really acted as this sort of trigger that brought a lot of things to the surface. A lot of problems and systemic issues that had been happening in wine country for a long time just got a lot worse. And so I was really interested in exploring that.
That's right. You make note that before the fires, rent in Napa and Sonoma counties were among the top 10 most expensive in the nation. And after the fires, rent increased 36%. And that ICE arrests increased as well. How did you earn the trust of your subjects?
It was really difficult, and for good reason. It's a really scary time for anyone undocumented to go on camera or talk to the media. And especially after the fires, the thing that drew me to this story the most was that I think there's a lot of coverage on detention centers and the border and all these really kind of flashy things happening around immigration, but we don't often hear about what it really feels like and looks like to live as an undocumented person in the U.S. And what I was hearing from people in wine country, which is this very fancy, luxurious tourist region, is just this real palpable fear that people were living with every day. And so that was something I really wanted to portray in the film, but that was also a huge barrier to getting people to trust us and be in the film. So it just took a long time of getting the trust of certain people in the community. So I started with my main character, Consuelo, who does outreach for a local nonprofit. And she was able to really kind of speak as a proxy for the community because she lived undocumented for many years. So she could speak to the experience, but she has citizenship now. So she was in a safe place to be on camera and to talk about it. And through her and through gaining the trust of other people in the community, then we were able to find people who were comfortable going on camera, and we took a lot of legal precautions to protect them too. And so being able to explain that and talk through our process and the way that we were taking those precautions and protecting them legally, it helped too.
I want to ask a bit about the ins and outs of filmmaking because, I'm a writer. I don't know anything about visual arts. In terms of the protecting their confidentiality and the piece about translation, can you just make some process notes about, just terms of, not filming their faces, for instance, and, who did you have translate and what was that experience like?
Yeah, so I speak Spanish, but not fluently or perfectly at all. And I was very lucky. My classmate, Marianne, is from Venezuela, and she's a beautiful cinematographer. So she filmed about half of the stuff that ended up in the final film. And she was usually there for the first time I met people or for like a particularly sensitive interviews. And we just had a really good working relationship, and she knew the film very well. She knew what I was trying to accomplish. So she could kind of step in if I was not asking a question right, or if I needed help understanding what somebody was saying. And so we just had a really good relationship working together, and that helped a lot. And then I was able to do most of the translations from transcripts myself. And then I had someone else check over the whole film before it was done to make sure that it was fully accurate. For filming people that might not have legal status or who we needed to keep anonymous, we always made sure to ask for their consent before even filming their back or their hands. And a lot of people said no, that they weren't comfortable with that. And so then we'd turn the camera off and not film them. But we also, one of the pivotal interviews in the film is an anonymous interview, and kind of the traditional way of doing an anonymous interview is to film someone in silhouette so that they're all
right.
dark and you can't see their face. But I felt that it was really, really important to show how this woman was feeling, because I just don't think that's something we hear about or see very often. And so I just really wanted to humanize the experience of being undocumented, and in her case, living in really unlivable housing conditions. Luckily, Marianne, my camera person, got really creative and filmed it in a really beautiful way so that her body language and emotion really came through without ever showing any identifying characteristics.
You also rely on drone footage of the landscape, found footage, I'm assuming, of the fires, and your own camera work. Can you just describe matching up those different styles of filming with the content and the plot?
I had to get very creative in this film in a lot of ways, because in many ways I was trying to convey something that you can't really see. I was trying to convey feeling and an entire community of people that really are invisible and living in the shadows. So in some ways that was difficult, but in other ways it was kind of fun because I got to get creative. And I felt like the drone photography was really important, because I didn't really realize this until I started filming in Napa and Sonoma, but they're both valleys. So it's very hard to get a feeling of the scope of wine country and kind of the landscape of wine country unless you're in the air. And in this film, I think the landscape is a really important character. It's a big part of the story, and it's kind of the common theme throughout the whole film. So drones really came in handy in both kind of showing the landscape and showing the burn area, which is really hard to see unless you're above it. And then the found footage from the fires was also incredibly important. I'm very grateful the Sonoma newspaper, the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, their reporters were on the ground through the fires filming out in the neighborhoods and were on the front lines of the fires filming, and they were generous enough to let me use their footage. But the other thing when I approached this film that I was noticing was that it's hard to convey how scary the fires were unless you were there. And so I felt like it was very important to include footage from the front line of the fires. You really felt that fear, because I think fear is another just really common theme throughout the film.
Absolutely. You know, at one point, one of your subjects says something to the effect of, if the fires come, go into the water, as in the ocean, and that would be a better fate than risking being found out by ICE. Where did your emotions go when you heard things like that?
I just got the chills just hearing that quote again. It was one of the most stunning things that Consuelo said to me. And that was our first ever interview, and I wasn't even sure I was going to use it. It was just kind of an initial get-to-know-each-other interview, and she sat down and just started telling me about how people had fled to Bodega Bay, which, for people that aren't from the Bay Area, Bodega Bay is, depending on where you are in wine country, it's 1 to 2 hours from Napa or Sonoma. And it's not water that you would ever want to swim in. It's quite scary. There's big waves and cliffs, and it's cold water. So the fact that people fled there and felt like going into the water in Bodega Bay was safer than going to a shelter was just a really stunning revelation, and felt like a really important thing to include in the film.
The film ends in an unresolved way, pointing to the collision of the luxury of wine pushed up against the inability for undocumented workers to have their most basic needs met, like housing. What's your hope for, you know, for viewers of the film?
I hope that people that see the film get a different perspective, maybe on the privileges that people with legal status have and all of the things that we may take for granted. I know that was something that I thought about a lot in making the film. The most basic things, like going to the grocery store or going to the doctor, are something I feel safe doing, but many people who don't have legal status don't feel safe doing it right now. And I think, though this story is sort of a local wine country story, I think these natural disasters are happening everywhere, and they're becoming more and more common, and there's going to be a most vulnerable population no matter where you are. And I think it's really important, as things are changing and the environment is getting more volatile, that we always look to who's impacted the most and think about how we can help. And luckily, in wine country, in many ways, things feel very hopeless there. Still, there hasn't been a lot of big systemic change, but Napa County has been very responsive to this film, and they they're really excited about it, and they're working on arranging public screenings and trainings around it. And I do feel like Napa and Sonoma counties both learned a lot from the disaster and are really working hard to figure out how they can respond better to the next one, which is nice to see and gives me hope.
That was Eva Rendell discussing her film, All That Remains. She's an award-winning documentary filmmaker and journalist. To see a trailer of All That Remains and to find more information about Eva and her work, visit our website, mtpr.org. Many thanks to the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival for their support and to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.